can see how technology, there we go. Technically challenged. Thank you all for being here. Thank you, Diane, for the gracious introduction. As LBJ would say, my dad would have liked it, but my mother would have believed it. So it's really great to be here with you all because, you know, you all do a lot of good work. And working with Diane, as I have over the years, even before she came here, has been a real pleasure. Top-notch organizer. So the book, I was never going to write this. I was at having lunch with this Lutheran minister, ACL, Austin City Lutherans. He calls it the other ACL. So we were doing stuff with Casa Marianella. So his group picks up furniture and we help place it with apartments with people, Casa Marianella. Anyway, so I was sitting there and was kind of BSing like lawyers do and telling him all my war stories, you know. He said, "You got to write a book." I said, "I am not going to write a book, no." So by the time I get back to my house, he has already called UT Press. So anyway, I ended up thinking about doing it because I wanted to honor the people that I worked with. I didn't want to write it about me and all that, but I wanted to write it and I wanted to honor the people that I worked with because they deserve it, they made great sacrifice, tremendous amount of time and energy they put into it, and that I wanted to put their names into history, and I wanted also to look at them as an example of people who worked for justice against the most oppressing conditions in South Texas, right? And then, of course, I had to throw in some personal stuff, which I try to do by telling jokes in the book and all that. But the purpose of the book is to honor people. The farm workers in Texas, even though they were connected, the union was connected to the UFW, basically were on their own to organize because of what was going on in California with the effort to change the law. Fred Ross, who worked with Saul Linsky at the Industrial Areas Foundation, came and taught us how to do house meetings. And so what we did in house meetings is that, you know, in the Valley you have these colonias that are essentially rural ghettos without public services, roads weren't paved, didn't have drinking water, didn't have to cart water in these big oil barrels. You can imagine how healthy that was. So we started the organizing. And the house meetings, like after once a year, each colonia would send a committee to the farm worker convention that we held in FAR. And there the people would decide what they were going to work on. And I think, you know, and the idea for lawyers, for us, was to support whatever the people wanted. It wasn't, "Yeah, let's do this." You know, the lawyers can say that. Sometimes we do that. We walk into a community and do what we want to do, and then we walk out. But the important thing for me was that we had to support the community organizing, to make that organizing stronger, and to be their legal voice. And so the farm workers would get together and have a convention and decide on the priorities. In one of the pictures in the book, this is, I really, really love. These are farm workers at a convention, sitting at the table. This is the first time farm workers got together to decide what they wanted. Up until that point, it was always what, "We'll tell you what you want." It was so impactful. And so the thing is, the convention, the workers go through the, you know, talk about priorities and decided that they were going to do what they wanted to do was workers' comp. So workers' comp, as a lot of you probably know, if you are injured on the job, you get a payment for medical care, you get payment for lost time. If there's a death, your family gets a payment. It's not great, it's Texas, of course, so the law is not great, but it is something. The only group excluded from that were farm workers. even though farm work is the most dangerous occupation in the state, in the country, people were excluded from it. Think about that. So construction's up there, but they have workers' comp, right? So that became the organizing agenda. And so people got together, organized to come up here and lobby the legislature, came up here to organize politically, that kind of stuff. And we did a little old lawsuit. And you're not going to believe this, but we used the Texas Equal Rights Amendment. Texas has an Equal Rights Amendment. I know a lot of you are going to shock. Passed in a fit of populism, good populism, in 1972. No discrimination on the basis of race, sex, national origin, religion, or color. So we use that constitutional provision to say the only people excluded are farm workers who are Latino, Hispanic. And Harley Clark was a judge, and he said, yeah, let's give that a whirl. And it worked. And you can read about all the exciting details about the legislature shutting down first time so we couldn't pass the law. It was pretty exciting. But I want to tell you a story about this, because this is these are the people that I was so blessed to work with. I want to tell the story of Genoveva Puga. Genoveva Puga migrated to Ohio to pick tomatoes. So I started off working in Michigan. That's where I'm from. And I ended up in the Valley because we had, in Michigan, 200,000 people from the Valley would go migrate to pick berries and cherries and strawberries and raspberry, all that huge migration. And that's how I started working, and then I ended up in the Valley. And so Genoveva Puga, so the migrant stream not only went to Michigan, but it went to Ohio, Florida, and then over in Montana sometime. But she was in Ohio working. Her son had stayed behind to work in the orchards. He was in Edinburgh. And it was the citrus time, citrus harvesting, cleaning, basically. But so he had if you take this here, this console, this is what the crates look like. Wood, filled with citrus. Million, you know, figure that, 1.5 tons maybe? They're heavy. Anyway, he was lifting one of the forklift, and the forklift malfunctioned. He got down to adjust it, and it fell over on him and crushed him to death, her son. It says something about the company that they didn't discover this for 6 hours. So we don't know, you know, did he die immediately? Was it a slow, painful death? We have no idea. But they could not find Genoveva, the mother, because this is before cell phones. So they had to call around to the different growers and all of that. They finally located her. And by the time she comes back to Hidalgo County, her son has been buried. And all she knows is that he's in a pauper's cemetery, what we used to call pauper's cemeteries. I'm sure we have a different word now. And so she has to go from cemetery to cemetery finding her son. And here's the picture. It was on the front page of the Brownsville Herald. You can see her. Okay? So, and you can see how much disrepair the cemeteries. So farm workers had decided already they're going to start working for workers' comp, right? And so she walks into the office one day after this decision was made, and she said, I want to sue Donna Fruit because they won't pay workers' comp to my son. He was married, had two little kids. They weren't going to pay workers' comp. So, of course, I took the case, and we went all the way up to the Supreme Court, came back down, and we settled it. We got it, what she would have gotten had there been workers' comp. But here's what she said. you know, this doesn't change the law. It just means I got paid. It didn't change the law. I am going to work with you until that law changes so nobody else has to suffer what I did. And then she was there every time we had a session, legislature. She was there, petite little grandma, who wasn't ever going to let anybody off the hook. And I'm sure you know the kind. And finally, after a bunch of machinations that went on with the legislature, all that, and Mark White came to the rescue. Mark White goes to the Rio Grande Valley, to the shrine of the Basilica of La Virgen de San Juan, to sign the law. And Hanalveva Puga standing next to him. You know, isn't that amazing? She's standing next to him. But those are the kinds of people that I worked with. And these are who I wanted to honor in the book. You know, just these wonderful, wonderful people that made enormous sacrifice. Think about this. These are farm workers. These are already the poorest of the poor, the most oppressed of the oppressed. Nobody's going to pay for them to go lobby the legislature. They would come up here, sleep in people's houses, right? And give up that pay that they might have gotten because they were working for the movement, working for La Causa, working for everybody to bring justice to the valley. So that's, we win that. The second one is unemployment comp. Farm workers did not get unemployment benefits. Same thing with construction, right? Construction. So if when the building is done, they get unemployment. Seasonal. Except farm workers didn't get it. So we filed that suit. We did that organizing and got it. And then we had first year and a half brought in something, between those two lawsuits, brought in something like $11 million to the valley. Because before that, if somebody was hurt or unemployed, poor people had to take care of them, right? That poor, already a poor area. And so we went through this. We also right to know about pesticides in the workplace. So they, like Diane's here, you know, and they use pesticides, they have to tell her what they're using. Farm workers are excluded. So you've probably seen pictures of airplanes going over, yes, spraying. And you know, that's awful. It's hazardous. And it's particularly hazardous if you're pregnant. But there was no way of knowing what chemicals are they using. So we organized and changed that. And also then banned the short-handled hoe, which was about that long. Short-handled, so you take a hoe, regular hoe, cut it down. And so people were using that short-handled hoe. And anytime they stood up, then the presumption was they weren't working. So think about that. What is your back gonna be like by the time you're 50 or 45? And it's left over from slavery. There was and here we have it in Texas. So that went by. That Lena Guerrero, who was a state rep here, who's passed away, helped pass that. And then no toilets in the fields. So if you had to relieve yourself, you had to go find a tree or whatever. And what would happen is when one of the women had to relieve herself, the other women would form a circle around her to protect her dignity. That meant everybody lost work because there was no toilet. Can you imagine? Anyway, now there is. But this is because of all the organizing that people did. We always wanted to work with groups or people in the community to strengthen that organizing. Not only to strengthen it, because if you make a change, that organization is going to make sure that change sticks because they fought for it, right? Lawyers can go ahead and change the law, walk out, and then a year later you're back to where you were. But if you have the community doing it, it sticks. So then when you go vote, don't forget, when you go vote, Notice that there's an earpiece for people who are blind. That's because of the El Paso disability group, Volard. Right? That changed voting across the country because of their activism. Another lawsuit we had with them, Cinemark. So when you go to a movie these days in stadium style seating, the wheelchair seating is in the middle. Yeah. Instead of down in front of the screen on the floor, which I learned through the lawsuit is also the loudest place to be because the sound is being blasted through the screen, right? That's because of El Paso Disability Group. We did 550 cases under the Americans with Disabilities Act because the community was so involved, so active. And we were there. It was our honor to do that. Just wonderful. And in many respects, you know, I write about this in the book. A lot of times, this is a really kind of spiritual enterprise we're in, you know, because these are people that are resisting nonviolently what's the oppression that's going on around them. I have a picture of Frank Lozano in here, who is, you know, one of the disability organizers in El Paso. Totally nonviolent, but man, he was in jail a lot because he knew how to use nonviolent resistance and change the law. So anyway, that's there in the book. There are a lot of stories. But here's what I want to get across to me, and I use these events to talk about how we need to pick up the challenge and continue it. Right? All the people that have fought for civil rights, all of the people who were black, who were hanged and mutilated obscenely, 4,000, all of the Latinos, Mexicanos, South Texas that were shot in the back, 5,000, in the 10 years called the Hour of Blood, La Hora de Sangre. They did not do that expecting that we were gonna do nothing. They made that sacrifice, they knew that risk. If they insisted on their property, if they insisted on voting, they knew the risk. But they took that risk in the hope that we would pick it up and continue it. They lived in a situation worse than what we're living in, which is bad. But they lived in that with the hope that they were gonna get us to where we are and expected that we were gonna pick it up and keep it going, that we weren't gonna sit around and whine, complain, wring our hands. And that's the challenge, is to do that. What can we do? What do we need to do? And there's no end of the possibilities, but it's figuring it out. What can each of us do? Each of us has different talents. And maybe you go try something and you don't like it. You know, as I said earlier, there are over 1,000 volunteer organizations in Travis, in Austin, you know, and 10 times that in the county. Do something. The Brian Stevenson Equal Justice Initiative, you might have heard, or a wonderful guy, has four things, to which I add a fifth, six, and seven. Four things, he says. Be proximate. That means get out with the people, right? It's not like, you know, we'll just kind of show up here and send something over there, but get out and see the people, be proximate. Change the narrative. I talked about that this morning. Change the narrative. Have hope. And do uncomfortable things. None of this, you know, just imagine showing up somewhere for the first time to volunteer is not going to be comfortable. But do it. You know, do it. Our comfort is not to get in the way of our fight for justice. I add spirituality. I was at a talk before I retired, sort of retired, before I left the Civil Rights Project. And it was a panel, four of us. We were called activists, of course. And so we all, you know, tell our stories about all our woes and how hard the battle is and all that. And finally, at the end in the Q&A, this student stood up. I've never seen, all the talks I have been at and done, I've never seen this happen. She stood up and said, "Okay, I've heard all the bad stuff. What keeps you all going?" I thought, oh man, how do I answer that? And fortunately, they started at the other end of the table. But you know what? Every one of us said spirituality. Every one of us had a completely different sense of what that meant. But it was that's what sustained, gave us hope, and got us up in the morning. And I think having that sense of spirituality is so important. Mother Teresa would say, you know, I spent a lot of time asking God to do this and God to do that and God to do that. I finally understood that the purpose of prayer is for me to sit there and let God tell me what to do. That's it. That's it. You know, have that kind of, that spiritual discernment to go through, you know, and how we build that community, how we have that vision of God. I love talking to church groups because I can use this language, right?
Yes.
There's some places I go and you have to be sort of, you know. But that's it. That's it. It's really, really important. I have a quote somewhere. I'll just paraphrase it since I can't find my papers. So Eleanor Roosevelt, right, who helped write the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, on one of the anniversaries of it, actually, I think you found
it. This is it.
Thank you. Man, see what I mean about Diane?
She's always there.
Here's her quote. "Where, after all, do universal human rights begin? In small places, close to home, so close and so small that they cannot be seen on any maps of the world. Such are the places where every man, woman, and child seeks equal justice, equal opportunity, equal dignity, without discrimination. And unless those rights have meaning there, they have little meaning nowhere." Okay? Beautiful. Let's change it. Where, after all, does gospel justice come from? Where does it begin? In small places, close to home, so close and so small, it's not on the map. Those are the places where the gospel brings equal justice, equal opportunity, equal dignity, without discrimination. Unless the gospel has meaning there, it has no meaning at all. Right? There is no difference between the gospel and human rights. There's no difference. It's gospel work. So let me wrap up with this. When Robert Kennedy, this is the good Robert Kennedy. I don't know why I keep getting the same reaction every time I say this everywhere. When he was running for president, you know, the idea was you had to go visit foreign countries to show your cred, why you could handle the office, foreign policy. So he was going to go to South Africa. And he had to choose. South Africa did not want him there. It was still apartheid. In fact, told him, "We're not going to protect you if you come." And he had to choose, do I go to a black university and talk? Do I go to a white university and talk? And he went to the white university because he tells the students, "You have to make the change. You are the ones that have the power." And in that speech that he gave, this is in Cape Town, and it's
This is what he says. You've heard some of this. Each time a person stands up for an ideal, and here we can put in gospel, or acts to improve the lots of others, or strikes out against injustice, that person sends forth a tiny ripple of hope. And crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, these ripples build a current, tsunami, which can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance. The greatest danger in our time is timidity. Timidity. Few are willing. Oh, this is the people locked in the room today, right? The disciples. Timidity. Few are willing to brave the disapproval of their fellows, the censure of their colleagues, the wrath of their society. Moral courage, and let's call it gospel courage, is a rarer commodity than bravery in battle or great intelligence. Yet, moral courage, gospel courage, is the one essential, vital quality of those who seek to change a world that yields most painfully to change. Yet, gospel courage is the one essential, vital quality of those who seek to change a world that yields most painfully to change, and those with the courage to enter that moral conflict, that gospel conflict, will find themselves with companions in every corner of the globe. And that's where we are, in our corner, and it's a pleasure and honor to have been here talking with you all today. I guess I should ask for questions. Oh, let me tell you a story. It's a problem when you have a lawyer talk. I want to tell you something that I saw happen that profoundly affected me. So one night, this is back in the days when lawyers had to actually go to the office, and we didn't have computers. So I was working on a brief about 1 o'clock. Was coming back home, and I stopped at Fiesta to buy milk for the kids. And I was the third person in line. The first person in line was a very poor Hispanic woman, maybe 45, maybe, very poor. And she was buying food with food stamps. And if you remember food stamps, it was like Monopoly money. Sure. Remember those days?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, yes, really. And the cashier, who's Latino, Hispanic, and make sure I come back to this point later, was giving her an incredibly awful time, berating her, and just, it was absolutely awful. And I was thinking, oh man, I probably have to say something. Anyway, got done, the woman left. The second person in line was an Anglo woman, very well dressed for 1 o'clock in the morning, or at least compared to my shorts and t-shirt. And she gets up there, and it's night and day. You hear about this, but you rarely see it, where the treatment that the Anglo woman got was just totally different. When that transaction is over, the Anglo woman says, you know, I really appreciate the respect and dignity you showed me. I only wish you would have done it for the woman in front of me. That's what we need to do. How many times do we see that and do nothing? Right? She changed me. And I hope she changed the cashier, because the cashier was co-opted by our society. She was parroting what she was taught. And I hope the Anglo woman had an impact on changing that, but she had an impact on changing me. And we can do that with everybody. We can do that with everybody. Okay. You better slip in a question, else I'll keep talking. Or you don't have to. We can. Yes.
What about the church's role in our society today, and what has happened to the church?
Well, I don't know what's happened to the church, but it's not there, right? Or at least as well as it should be. I think what's happened to the church historically gets intertwined with power, money, right? It's not the message of Jesus. How many crusades have we killed people as part of spreading the gospel? Or, as I said today, our defense secretary invoking the name of Jesus to kill people in Iran. But where are the churches? Right? There should be an enormous uproar. This is a safe issue for even the church. You cannot threaten to obliterate a whole country. That we call that genocide, which is a war against, a crime against humanity. But where are the churches? Right? I mean, the best we can see right now, I mean, the Pope finally is moving. But how can you not move? That's it, right? So I've worked with churches, all kinds of churches throughout my life. I am in a part of a church now. And it just, it, so much of it was just hitting your head on the wall because it seems clear this is what the church ought to be doing. But the thing is, we are the tail that wags the dog, so we do it, and then let the church figure it out, right? But this is the same thing with lawyers. So we thought, you know, we had the idea, and a lot of our society does, that the Supreme Court gives us our rights. And we're seeing what happens with that thinking now. But the reason that the Supreme Court made changes is because people organized. The Republican judges desegregated the South, not because they were sympathetic, but because of all the organizing that went on. We were the tail that wagged the dog, and the courts had to catch up. And I think that's the same story with the church. The church has to catch up, right? So I'm not advocating splitting off from the church, but I think our job is to raise our voice to point the church in the right direction. And I'm sure we went through this since the very beginning of the church. That's the best I can. Yes?
I think a lot of us struggle with, in a partisan era, where certain topics get quoted not as human rights or justice, but as belonging to one political team,
mm-hmm. Right? Right.
Churches who want to attract all teams, right? We want all teams to be in our pews, but to thread the needle of being the prophetic voice, such as you have, without looking like or coming across that you can only go one way and be this. What do you say?
Well, I mean, it's a tough one, but the way I try to handle it, let's say you're talking to Christians, right? The mandate of Jesus is to feed the poor. Pure and simple. That is non-negotiable. But this is where politics comes in. How do we do it, right? So I think that's where you can have talk about dialogue. How do we do it, right? I think that's the opening. We get everybody on board that this is a non-negotiable mandate. But what is negotiable is what's the best way that we can do this and try to get there that way, right? And I think we have to respect my brother who has passed away, my younger brother. Our politics were just. But I really learned to respect what he did. He worked in Habitat for Humanity and got backpacks for kids at the school and all that. And so we could come together on stuff, right? We may not have the same politics, but we came together, and there was a time when Diana was working the legislature when you could get Republicans and Democrats to sit down and negotiate. You can't do that now, right now, at least for a while. It'll come back, probably. But that's the way I deal with it. This is a gospel thing, and the politics comes in how do we do it. Not whether we do it, but how we do it.
I have a question about organizing in Texas, where so much legislating has been done, and I think it's absurd legislation, but people hear it's illegal. But collective bargaining in a lot of fields is illegal in Texas. And I, for me, again, I'm like, heck, that doesn't actually make any sense. But like, when it comes to organizing for schools or laborers or doctors, I mean, how do you see a way forward in a landscape where a lot of people who have those positions say, well, I have mine, and I don't want to lose what I have, and I know that it's illegal to do this, and I'm scared? That's a big question.
Well, I mean, part of the problem that you're dealing with, that we deal with, is this incredible individuality that we live with in our society, right? I mean, so your argument would be perfect if we're talking about community. How does this fit the community? Community is better off by organizing, right? But because of this rigorous individualism that we have, it undercuts that, and that makes it really, really dangerous. I think this is one of the problems that churches have had, too, and that is not preaching community, right? There's too much individuality. But I think to go to your point, you know, when you watch the Super Bowl, think of the commercials. How many commercials did you see? Here's how you can help your community. Yeah, right. If you saw one, let me know. But what were they? They were all about individuality.
Selfishness.
Yeah. Eat this. Drink this. Yeah, that is, I mean, a real problem with our economic system, right, is that it fosters, it depends on, thrives on that individualism. And so getting that message, that was the thing that was so great about working with the farm workers in the disability community, is that there was that cohesion of community that you could deal with. And that's the big thing. I mean, that you've put your finger on it right away, right? So I have a good friend who's a priest and an organizer, union organizer for airlines, and that's what he's facing all the time, right? And the opposition, they are so sophisticated. They are so sophisticated, you know? And it's a struggle. It's a struggle. The one thing that we cannot do is depend on social media. You have got to get out on your feet and do it. Because all you're doing on social media is you're not doing anything except talking to the choir. And who owns social media? It's in their interest that we not organize. So social media can be good, but it's not to think that's our answer. It's always, you always have to go back to the community. That was the beauty of the house meetings. Community.
I'm going to make one plug before I need to get him to start signing books and selling books. But I want to make one plug for a week. In 2 weeks, we're going to do a talk. The advocacy committee is going to do a talk for our Call to Feed the Hungry campaign, which is a diocesan-wide effort to focus on, and he was just talking about something that unites people. It's going to be a real bipartisan effort to try to get SNAP funding in the state of Texas. And it's a campaign that we've launched throughout the diocese, and it will be throughout Texas as well. I hope you'll come to our presentation on the 26th on that, because I think it's a really important effort to try to get full state funding for SNAP. There is a chance that for the first time Texas has to fund SNAP at a whole new level. It's a critical issue that we're facing in the state, and we're going to need to be all hands on deck on it. And I think I'm real proud of the unifying effort that's going to be put forward on the parts of faith communities to do that. So please come to that on the 26th, all right? But I want to thank Jim for speaking and give you a chance to buy that Christmas book. Thank you so much.
Thank you.